Jewish marriage has been saved and, you know, enhanced by the laws that we are going to review or learn together tonight. And I use the word myth very strongly, because if we look around at the Jewish marriage, it's not in great shape, meaning the divorce rate in Israel is somewhere between 30 and 50%. Even in the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox communities, it's growing. The truth is, the more work I do in the Middle Ages, for instance, in Ashkenaz, a tremendous amount of divorce. I'm teaching that right now in Matan, that unit. A lot of divorce, a lot of unhappiness, a lot of women throughout the ages coming and suing for divorce because of sexual incompatibility. Again, abuse is a much more modern grounds for divorce, meaning men hitting their wives would not have been grounds in the Middle Ages, but certainly today that would be grounds. Financial distress, men who travel too much. And so there is a bit of a myth that these laws, you know, have kind of safeguarded and preserved happiness. As I say to all the couples I teach, it's what you put into it, meaning in a healthy, respectful, loving relationship, these laws can give a committed sexual relationship, a marital relationship, a lot of meaning. I'll even use the word sanctity. In an abusive or unhappy relationship, these are poison, and these contribute to the atmosphere of poison, control, abuse. And so I want to be both honest and careful here tonight, meaning I'm not coming to, you know, do an expose on the laws of family purity, and that's actually a term I hate, because we're not dealing with purity. We're dealing with permitted and prohibited sexual relations. Even the fact that we use language like impure and pure has kind of sullied the conversation. Certainly today, certainly for feminists who, and certainly for the reform and the conservative movements, who are like, well, you know, what is pure and impure? It sounds like a laundry detergent, meaning are women clean? Women are clean all the time. So what's this purity language? It's very misogynistic. I'm going to frame the conversation both through the sources and by telling questions, using questions I've had or issues that I've seen have come up. Next week, we're going to continue with the topic of sexual pleasure, what Judaism has to say about sexual pleasure, which is quite a lot. And there we'll have two, in addition to Jody, who will talk less about therapy and more about physiology, Natan Alexander, who has started a website called Better Together, which is a kosher sex accessories or sex toys, depending on what language you want to use, site, which is, again, addressing some of the issues I'm going to be bringing up tonight and continuing with tomorrow. And he will come towards the end and just, you know, talk a little bit about what he's doing. It'll be a nice integration of both Jewish sources and information about sexual pleasure throughout a lifetime. Because I think we're all familiar. I talked about, you know, kind of the hookup culture, junk sex, when we're young, and then, you know, the adultery challenge I mentioned way back in the very beginning, Ashley Madsen. But again, sexuality ebbs and flows throughout people's life cycles, and having a little bit of an understanding of when one may find an ebb or a flow or a sudden, like, kind of burst, sometimes it's helpful to know a little bit about how the body works throughout, you know, throughout one's life cycle. Okay, biblical versus rabbinic nida. So we're going to open up with chapter 15 in Leviticus in Vayikra. V'isha, does everyone have a source sheet? V'isha ki tiyah zava, adam yeh zova bivsara, shivat yamim tiyah benidata, v'kol anogea ba yitma ad ha'arev. So we have a source in which it says clearly that if a woman has zivut, has an issue, has a discharge of blood, and the blood is in her flesh, which was understood to mean from within, as opposed to vaginal bleeding, which does not cause a woman to be impure or prohibited. Again, I'm going to play with both those terms. Uterine blood, which comes from within the flesh, was considered to be blood that caused a woman to be ritually impure. I'll just at this point remind everyone that in chapter 15, we have an equal balance between male and female impurity. The chapter actually opens with men who have some sort of gonorrheic discharge from their sexual organ, some sort of non-seminal emission, right? Then a seminal emission, then sperm, then the menstruant woman, and then the woman who has uterine bleeding outside of her period. So the chapter, again, for those who are into biblical structures, chiastic, right? It's ABBA, meaning it's a beautifully structured chapter in which we see the absolute equality between men and women throughout their lives when they have discharges from their sexual organs. It creates ritual impurity. And something I always point out is there is nothing wrong with being impure, meaning from chapters 12 till chapter 15 in Leviticus, where this system is presented, the leper, the birthing woman, the leper, and then chapter 15 as I described it, nowhere does it suggest that it's an abomination to be impure, that it's bad to be impure, that God gets angry if you're impure. Rather, God basically says, if you want to live, you will stay away from my presence in the tabernacle when you are impure. Vihizartem, you have been warned so that you shall live. That's at the very end of chapter 15. And really, it is what I call proximity to holiness requires utmost caution. When you draw near to God's presence in the temple or the tabernacle, you must follow a certain system, a protocol of rules and laws and boundaries. And it meets men and women very much equally. Okay, yes, there's no parallel to the birthing woman, and not yet either. However, the birthing woman is really a nida, meaning she's someone who has uterine blood that makes her impure. So it's true that she has a certain amount of days she waits after birth, but really it's a derivation or a subset of the menstruating woman. We then see in chapter 25, I'm still in the first box, chapter 15, verse 19, the biblical nida is nida for 7 days, 7 days total. Now that's going to be very important because today, for instance, we have a debate raging largely between Orthodoxy and conservative, or even within more modern to more traditional Orthodoxy, whether we should go back to the biblical system of nida. So pay attention, I will come back to this. The nida is nida for 7 days total. From the first day she gets her period, her issue, her zivut, she becomes impure, which I hope I brought. Wait a minute. No, I did not bring Perek Yudchet. That was a problem. Okay, we'll get to Yudchet. It's on page 5. Good. We're going to get to chapter 18 in a minute. So she is impure. In verse 25, we find out, if a woman is yazov zov dama yamim rabim, she has an issue of blood for many days, not at the time of her period, or if she has an issue beyond the time of her period. In other words, already 3,000 years ago, they understood a woman's period, the Torah understood, a woman's period should not be longer than 7 days, and physiologically, a period should not last more than 6. 4 to 6 days is a normal period. More than that, it's often not blood anymore, meaning women who think, oh, I bleed for 7 or 8 days, you'll often find that they actually stop bleeding at around day 6, but they have all sorts of other colors that come out of their body, right? Kind of the end of the period, the detritus that's left. So it's not really blood. It's the kind of the detritus at the end of the period. It's not the period. So more than 7 days is abnormal, meaning it's something unusual, and the impurity that it incurs is a different kind of impurity. So either bleeding for many days, minimum 3 in the halachic interpretation, not at the time of her period, or bleeding beyond the time of her period for many days. And then finally, we find out in verse 28, Im tara mizova v'safrala shivat yamim v'achar titar. If she becomes purified, if the bleeding stops, she counts 7 days clean of the bleeding, like a man, by the way, who has a gonorrheic emission, meaning a man who has an unusual emission that is not semen, and it continues, you know, kind of they talk about either it stops him up or it's like a faucet, it continues to drip. He has to wait until he has 7 days clean of that discharge. He goes to the mikvah, he is then pure, and he has to bring sacrifices. Okay, that's the zav. The parallel is the zava. I say this because, again, rabbinically, we put the systems together, right? Those who are familiar know we've integrated the nida and the zava. Again, I will come back to this. I'm just throwing out some ideas so that they're familiar. So in the Torah text, in Leviticus 15, Vayikra Tetvav, we have a nida and we have a zava, two totally different constructs. The nida waits 7 days before going to the mikvah, 7 days total. The zava has to wait bleeding days plus 7 clean days before going to the mikvah. And in fact, she needed to bring sacrifices. Okay, clear? Good. If we take a look on page 5, I'm sorry, I usually put these things together. The next sources that we really need to look at is the fact that in chapter 18, I'm in section A, the second line in the box. Ve'el isha b'nidat tumata lo tikrav l'galot ervata. Suddenly in chapter 18, we rediscover the Nida. She's the only one who makes it onto both systems, meaning the system of purity and impurity, which is about God's presence in the temple, in the Mikdash, and onto the list of sexual prohibitions, right? So she is prohibited sexually. This is a permitted sexual relationship, which has times in which the woman is prohibited and times in which she's permitted. And it's going to be based on the times that she's Tameh and Tahor. So I don't actually care in chapter 18 whether she's Tameh and Tahor. I care whether she's Mutar or Asur. Is she permitted or is she prohibited? It is true that Tameh, impure, equals prohibited, and pure equals permitted. But it would be incorrect to say that a woman who has her period outside of being married to a priest has to worry continuously about her purity and impurity. She has to keep track of whether she's sexually permitted or sexually prohibited and then go to the mikvah to be permitted finally, right? The rest of the chapter 18 are fundamentally prohibited relationships, right? Incest, bestiality, homosexuality, which we talked about last week, right? Those are all relationships which are fundamentally prohibited in chapter 18. Largely, the punishment is death. Chapter 20, I don't have it here, but brings us death, 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 death. There are a few punishments that are excommunication, karet, right? We don't know exactly what karet means. It means some sort of disconnect with, it says, v'yichvertu shneihem bekerav amam. They will both be cut off from among their people. But at this point, I always point out that it's not death, right? And of course it's not death. Because if a couple goes into a bedroom and they're permitted to each other, and even we, all peeping Toms, look in and see them having sex, we may find it very exciting and interesting, but we're not going to call the modesty police because ultimately they are permitted. Whereas if we see, lo aleinu, a father and a daughter, or we see a couple committing adultery, or we see, again, siblings going into a bedroom and we happen to, again, be peeping Toms and watching, we may very well call social services. We may also call the police, right? So the Nida woman is not the kind of relationship that involves the society or the community. It's on the access of God and the couple, because no one else is supposed to know when the couple is having sex or not. I mean, it's absolutely up to the couple. The couple has a relationship in which sex is allowed. There are times where they are prohibited to have sex. Who's going to know? The couple. Okay, and so that's what makes the Nida different than everything else on the list in chapter 18. It is that the woman is fundamentally permitted to her partner, a.k.a. husband, in the Torah, right? Even though the Torah doesn't actually talk here about marriage, it's assumed that people will have sexual relationships when they have committed monogamous relationships. We talked about the non-marital in lecture number 2. So if anyone has a question, get back to me. But here again, to sanctify, and this is the chapter that I call Kedoshim Tiyu. You shall be holy. Meaning that is the title of chapters 18, 19, 20. And here God gets very angry. Meaning here we have language like abomination. Here the word tamei does not mean impure vis-a-vis God's presence, but impure as in defiling, as in the land will vomit you out. It's a much harsher language structure in these chapters. And this is where we understand that, sexual prohibitions are not going to be optional. Meaning, I can spend my life never going to the temple. I can spend my life never eating tithed food or eating meat. And if I'm vegetarian, I may never need to be pure, right? If I don't want to eat the Pesach offering, I may never have to go to I could be impure and I'm not married to a priest and I live in Kiryat Shmona and I'm not going to come to Jerusalem. So I'll spend my life being impure and I can be a very good Jew. But I cannot be a very good Jew or have a relationship with God if I violate chapter 18, the sexual prohibitions, which again, I know last week I talked about that painful place for people in homosexual relationships. Again, that was last week. I'm happy to take questions in the question issue. But really what chapter 18 is saying is sexuality is permitted, but within a context, within a framework. And this framework is fundamental to sanctity, to having a relationship with God. Okay, any questions? Something that wasn't clear before I move on. When the temple is destroyed, the entire system of purity and impurity falls apart. We don't need to have purity and impurity. We don't have tithes. We don't have sacrifices. Certain elements of it remain in the background, but largely it is the wrong language. The language is the language of permitted and prohibited. And guess who's left standing? The Nida. Right? The Nida is the only one left standing in the sense that she overlaps both systems. And so we're going to see the language of pure and impure make their way into even the way we, taharat mishpacha, family purity, right? The language of purity very much makes its way into conversations about women and the mikvah. But I would say Rav Knoll so beautifully wrote in his book, that's not what the conversation's about. It's about permitted and prohibited, and it's equal. It's an equal conversation. It's not that the woman's impure and there's an element of dirtiness or uncleanness and the man can't touch her because she contaminates. They are prohibited and permitted to each other, right, at different times. And that actually is a very important shift that it's not surprising Rav Knoll is sensitive to. But I would say, you know, many modern women find the idea of being impure or unclean particularly offensive, and then the whole system suddenly seems dissonant. So in Nida 66a, they begin to realize they have a challenge. 300 CE, between 200 and 300 CE. They have a challenge in general. How are they going to pack a suitcase for exile? How are they going to streamline Judaism? How are they going to construct the system we call halakha, halachic Judaism? How are we going to create fences to everything, right, that we do so that we don't violate biblical law? And I often get asked, did they make any fences for anything except the Nida? And I always say, yes, chicken, right? Chicken is the excellent example because chicken is permitted according to the Torah, and we don't, you know, no one considered chicken parmesan just is not a Jewish thing if you have even a minimally kosher kitchen, right? We all embraced chicken as being meat, whereas fish really remained outside the definition of meat. So what we're about to see, same movement, same idea, integrating systems to make life easier and less complicated for those who are going to have to live by these systems. So let's see what they did. This source is actually going to be a little confusing. I'll try to clean it up. Rav Yosef said that Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, Rebbe enacted in Sadot. Now, Sadot is supposed to be what my grandmother would call Yehapitzville, right? It's supposed to be in the middle of nowhere. It's supposed to be like a place where the women don't have rabbinic leadership, they don't have anyone to ask questions to, and they need to know what to do without any sort of complication, without, and so on. So that's where Sadot is. She saw blood for one day. She remained in a state of ritual impurity for six more days. So again, as we're reading this, modern, we say one day, that's not a period. I mean, yes, there are women who get their periods for one day. Usually that there's something a little, you know, a one-day period is not a normal period. But one day is not what we think of as a normal period. So why is she waiting six more days? Maybe she should wait 7 days, seven clean days, right, if that's abnormal. What are we doing with the 6 days? I'm not going to go into all the explanations. It's a little complicated. If she saw blood for 2 days, she also waits 6 days. At which point the woman is thoroughly confused because 2 and 6 equals 8, and I don't have 8 anywhere in the biblical system. I have sevens. I've got 7 days total, or I have clean days plus 7 days, but what's 2 and 6? Okay, there's a reason. Again, take my class in the spring and I'll go into it. And then if she sees blood for 3 days, she sits for 7 clean of blood days. Again, it's my, I always add that in, clean of blood days, not clean days. Women are clean, even when they get their periods. So she waits, and again, at this point, the women may be scratching their head and saying, again, I don't understand, meaning, am I a Zava? Am I a Nida? What am I? Meaning, if I see blood for 5 days and I know it's my period, why am I waiting 7 days? What am I doing here, right? And so at the very end comes Rabbi Zera. Jewish women took it upon themselves to deal stringently in this matter. Though they saw no more than a speck of blood, they would abstain for 7 clean of blood days. Okay, at which point, I would really like to give credit to B'nai Yisrael, I would, but it's hard because they don't do anything else in the Talmud. So why is it that suddenly here they become responsible for the weight of the entire complexity of the system? How did they carry? That's very empowering, you would think. But I have to say that it seems unlikely that B'nai Yisrael had a lot to do with this. I think that the rabbis were doing what the rabbis did best, which was to integrate and streamline two systems in which women became prohibited, right, sexually prohibited, because of uterine bleeding, the Zava and the Nida. At this point, I don't care that she's Zava or Nida. She's not bringing sacrifices to the temple anymore. I do care that she not be excommunicated, right, from within her people, or that they not be excommunicated. And so I want things to be very clear. And the way I want them to be very clear is really to tell all women, bleed, and then wait 7 days. And that way, we've simplified it for everybody. Right? Everyone will do the same thing, and we're going to see the Rishonim are going to say that, to avoid confusion. Like chicken, by the way. Again, what was their big concern with chicken? Chicken run around. right? They flap their wings and they make noises and so on. And so I might get confused when I prepare my chicken parmesan and then I go to the butcher and I see a slab of meat. I'm like, wait, I eat chicken. Can I eat meat? I can't remember, right? So to make things easier for the B'nai, you know, for all of us, they streamlined. Imagine if we had to have meat and milk and parv and then chicken. That would be a lot of fun, right? If we had our own set of dishes for chicken. So let's just say they streamlined the halachic system, and we're going to see the Meiri is going to say it very well. But the idea ultimately was that all women do the same thing. We like it when there's unity in the system. It's bad enough we have Sephardim and we have Ashkenazim, and the Sephardim have Taimanim and Iraqim and Moroccans and so on, all doing different customs. And in the Ashkenazim, we have Lithuanians and we have Hasidim. And so, as it is, we're a religion that has a lot of kind of variables as we practice our religion. Let's keep certain things the same. And take a look at the next source. The rabbis taught in a braita. This is a very important piece. One should not rise to pray, neither amidst the mental turmoil of having just judged a lawsuit, nor amidst the cognitive agitation resulting from having just studied an intricate matter of law, but rather amidst the mental calm that follows the study of a clear-cut law. And what is an example of a clear-cut law? Abaye said that of Rabbi Zera. Now, first of all, it's not very clear-cut, because I didn't even explain to you Nida 66, because it's a little complicated. But okay, basically it means everyone accepted Rabbi Zera. Really, that's why it's clear-cut. Because as complicated a process as it was to get there, everyone accepted it. In other words, from 2,000 years ago, Rabbi Zera, who lived in 300 CE, everyone was on board to integrate the system of Nida and Zava so that all women would wait bleeding days plus 7 days clean of blood. Okay, that became the system. We'll get to the next piece of how you determine all these factors. Look at the next two sources. The Rav Alfasi, who's the Rif in 1000 CE. Once the rabbis were diminished, for they used to be expert in such matters, but their judgment failed, and they were unable to distinguish between pure blood and impure. So this becomes interesting. This is the classic, woe is to us, we are no longer as great and as knowledgeable as those who came before us. And so the system had to change because we, the weaker, less astute scholars, and the Rif was not a weak or non-astute scholar, right? He's contemporary, more or less, of the Rambam, brilliant Talmudist. But he says, look, what can we do? They used to be experts, we're not. They also saw that women did not know their proper periods. The rabbis grew concerned and enacted an extra precaution that would eliminate any doubts and required waiting 7 clean days for all blood flows so as not to encroach upon a biblical prohibition. That's the key, by the way, the last line, not to encroach upon a biblical prohibition. The Meiri then says, Meiri is a couple hundred years later, 1400, 1500. The daughters of Israel later adapted an additional stringency of 7 clean days instead of 6. For they are apprehensive that upon seeing a sight of blood for which the rabbis enacted 6 clean days, they might come to error. Maybe she really was a Zava while thinking she's a Nida. She'll only count 6 clean days instead of 7. Although this apprehension is very unlikely, for why should they confuse between 6 and 7, which is quite discernible? Nonetheless, they were apprehensive about the few women who are not very knowledgeable, which is very nice of the Bnei Yisrael. Moreover, they felt it would be more convenient if the counting were the same for all women. So if you call out the window, hey, Shprinzi, how many days do I count again? Shprinzi doesn't start saying, well, how many days did you bleed, Chanelah, right? Everyone knows the same thing. Every Bat Yisrael is raised to understand, you bleed 7 clean days. That's more or less the rhythm. So one woman would not be counting 6 days, another 7. The committed women said to each other, there's not such a big difference between 6 and 7. So I established for themselves that each time they saw blood, they would treat it like definite zava, and even if it were only the size of a mustard seed, which is clearly from a closed womb, not an open one. That's also a bit of a myth, meaning, in other words, this idea that the size doesn't count. The size counts very much, and if uterine blood is not like a period, then women don't necessarily become prohibited. It's actually a much more complicated system than it appears to be, because women often have all sorts of uterine blood, not at the time of their period, and then what, we're going to make them prohibited, all that. So because it's a rabbinic system, there's a lot of leniency in the system. Like your kitchens, it's very hard to trafe up your kitchen. You can do it, you can have talent and do it, but often what happens is the food is okay, and sometimes you have to kosher the utensils or the pots, right? So it's a rabbinic system, which means built into the rabbinic system is a lot of room for leniency, and understanding that the system being rabbinic allows us to often permit women rather than prohibit them, as long as it's not their period. It's true, the stringency is every period comes with 7 days clean of blood, but outside of the period, a lot of times we can, not all uterine blood is equal, and not all uterine blood makes women prohibited. Okay? Yes, Andrew.
In a tribal society, biblically at this time, would this have provided a mechanism for women to enforce this behavior upon other women as well?
Very possibly. And there are articles about more, like you say, tribal communities, certainly in Africa, in the ancient Middle East, and so on. Many communities had kind of this, fear or revulsion of menstruation or concern that menstruant women would contaminate the tribe and so on and so forth. The fact that the Ethiopians had the tradition of building homes or huts for menstruating women was very in line with what other kind of communities were doing. I will say, to the credit of rabbinic Judaism, Judaism didn't go in that direction. So maybe. In the Talmud, they talk about sometimes women checking other women to make sure the period is over and so on and so forth. So usually when there are problems, not on a regular basis. But it's possible. I wouldn't eliminate that possibility, which, by the way, would make it more of a communal thing, meaning if all women know when everyone is having their periods, then maybe I am going to be suspicious if I see a couple go into the bedroom and, you know, fool around when they're having their period. There might have been more of a communal. I finished this piece, before I go on to the next piece, with Rabbi Avram Yisrael Reisner and Rabbi Miriam Berkowitz, two rabbis from the conservative movement, because I think it's important, you know, while Reform Judaism, and I don't want to say all Reform Judaism, and I'm not, I'm speaking from whatever little knowledge I have, but the Reform material I've read have largely, while mikvah, or the waters of the mikvah, and embracing the waters of the mikvah as a ritual that women can take for themselves is encouraged, around menstruation, not all rabbis encourage it, largely because they feel like it's a little misogynistic, What does this mean, that menstrual taboos and so on and so forth? So if anyone knows a different material for me to read, I'm happy to read it. The conservative movement has very much struggled with mikvah, because the conservative movement is committed to halachic Judaism, at least on the rabbinic level, very much so. And Rabbi Reisner says something interesting here in number one. We affirm the biblical requirement of marking a woman's monthly menstrual cycles by the biblically ordained 7-day abstinence. So there was, again, this is from the beginning of 2000, where Rabbi Reisner and Rabbi Berkowitz had an argument about whether they should go back to biblical nida or whether they should keep the rabbinic system of nida and zava. Okay, and so I'm bringing kind of the conclusions here that were developed, with Rabbi Reisner carefully developing a nida zava biblical system, and Miriam Berkowitz in the bottom saying, there's no need to reject the accumulated rabbinic tradition totally or ignore its delicate insights and wisdom. We as conservative Jews generally embrace rabbinic Judaism, not biblical Judaism or charism. And she goes on from there. And that's what I often say to couples who come in and talk, and they say, well, what about the biblical piece? Why aren't we going back to biblical Judaism? My response is often because we're rabbinic Jews, because we have been shaped and formed by the rabbinic system of law and everything that emerged after that. And if you want to go back to Shabbat and Kashrut that are biblical, then read the book, The Year of Living Biblically, and see what conclusions he came to. But it's not a religion that really developed itself past, 200 to 400, meaning it's not... Biblical religion is, like charism and the Shomronim and the Samaritans. It's hard to know what that means. There's so much that is difficult to interpret in the biblical text that today to live as biblical Jews would be quite challenging. There are people, I would say at this point, or couples, who choose to go back to the biblical model. They say, look, it's just too long. 7 days, especially when the woman has her period, for 5 or 6, I saw your hand, is doable. To wait another 2 days, not so bad. To wait 12, 13 days a month, that's really very challenging. And I know that certainly when Chiloni couples come, or a Chiloni Dati couple come, and talk about the challenges and the compromises they have to make, certainly with the Chiloni couples, I can say for sure, they will be encouraged to go towards a biblical model. As far as the rest of us, you're not going to find any kind of mainstream endorsement of it. I will just say that people often do what people do, and the more we educate people, the more they make their own decisions. And there is a movement to go back to biblical nida. Daniel Rosenach wrote a book. He's an OBGYN, Dr. Daniel Rosenach, who deals a lot with halachic infertility. He also is a religious Jew, and he has pushed the halachic community to consider biblical nida because he feels it's better for women's fertility and sexuality. And so he wrote a book arguing lahachzir nida liyoshna, to bring nida back as in days of old. You know, there's no question that couples read the book and decide on their own they're going to do what they're going to do. So I'm just throwing that out there. That's definitely one of the challenges that I think the rabbinic establishment, the halachic establishment has today. I will say there are a lot of ways to navigate the 10 to 12 days, 11 to 12 days that couples are prohibited, but it's definitely a challenge, which is what I'm going to talk about next. Yes?
You mentioned that how also with this and also with the chicken, for example, one of the reasons for the decision was about the confusion of the people. Now, I know that, like, I've explained that to, like, less religious friends or family members in the past, but the answer that they always give me, or the question that they always give me, which I've never had an answer to, so... So my question to you is, like, what, do they think that the people are that stupid that they don't know the difference between chicken or meat, and they don't think they can't count their own days? So that I never had, like...
First of all, the answer is, education of the masses, 100 years old? How long have people been thinking critically, 50, 60 years? Meaning people, all of us, men, women, different races, sitting, going to college and thinking in a historically critical way, analytical way. That's very recent. That doesn't mean that people weren't educated, but the majority of people were not educated. The majority of people were basically following whatever system was being set up. So I think the answer is yes. I think that there was a concern for confusion. I will say also that it doesn't always help us to understand the reason things shifted. Because when something shifts and becomes a cornerstone of a legal system, then if you start pulling out every piece of the legal system that no longer makes sense, you're not going to have a system. And I think ultimately, again, I think systems are a good way, especially legal systems, are a good way to create order and methodology and meaning, ultimately, again, spiritual meaning, godly meaning. Otherwise, you end up kind of with anarchy, which some people, you could go and meditate and feel close to God without doing all of this. But the halachic system is really a legal system like many other, with pieces that at different times need to be reevaluated. And are there any lawyers here? That's really a shame. Any legal system has pieces that are outdated to it, and yet the whole system doesn't suddenly wake up and say, okay, the Supreme Court today, let me use gun control, okay, as actually a very timely issue. Really, we're going back to the Constitution to say every man has a right to bear arms? Is that really relevant today? I mean, I apologize if there are any pro-gun people here. But there's no question in the last 10 years, the accidents that are not just accidents, the amount of weapons available to people who need very little background checking or any sort of training to get a hold of really mass weapons that kill is very minimal, and it's always back to the Constitution. Now, that's interesting, because you would think I would take that out of the Constitution, meaning it seems like maybe we should rewrite. People are very afraid to do so. What do you mean? How are we going to reread the Constitution? How are we going to rewrite the Constitution? That's a pinnacle of my right as an American, and so on and so forth. Now, our legal system's a lot older than that, and has a lot more grounding, at least in biblical interpretation and so on and so forth. And so I think one of the big struggles today are many of the chicken. I think I haven't heard a lot of people arguing to bring back chicken. We have so much we can eat that I think we're good with food. Although I will point out that anytime the OU koshers something that was treif, wow, the celebration that goes on. And it's as if like America finally has something to eat that's kosher. There's no question Jews love to eat food that has been their whole life like not kosher. It's like the biggest, you would think we're living, my daughter's in Accra in Ghana. She really doesn't have a lot to eat. They have to fly in, the meat or whatever it is. There I can understand the excitement when a new food goes on the market and you can eat it. It seems to me, it just shows again how we often reduce our religious experience to whether Oreos are kosher and whether they're meat or dairy, right? Whether they have margarine or not in them. That's another lecture series. But I will say that beyond nida and chicken, I think we have much bigger questions to ask of the halachic system about same-sex relationships, about the divorce system. We have much bigger questions to ask. And I would say certain things you just have to say that's the way it is and we're moving on, we'll do it, we won't do it, and so on. And certain things I think really need to be reevaluated. And the social structure right now, I think, is particularly imperative. Anyone else have a question before I go on?
Not to be on a tangent, but the right to bear arms in the American Constitution is an amendment to the Constitution.
Oh, well, I thought, oh, see, and there goes my ignorance. It's been a long time since. When was it? Right, it could be changed again, even stronger, even stronger. And people often present it as a constitutional right, which is interesting, and I always thought it was. Thank you. It just shows how, you know, you're brought up to believe, well, this is everyone's right, it's the Constitution. Well, why can't we question the Constitution? I mean, who wrote the Constitution, after all? We actually know who wrote the Constitution, and the question is why, you know, but to take the Constitution out of American law is to have the whole system essentially fall. Meaning, you have to have a starting point, you have to have structure, otherwise it implodes. What I want to talk about next, basically, again, just one more minute about what this system means. In addition to the days in which the couple is permitted and prohibited, and this is an important piece, women have to halachically establish, or establish through, you know, halachic means, that the bleeding has stopped. And that's why Rabbi Reisner, he talks in his thing about the bedika, or the checks that women do. I say that because I think, you know, Jody will probably address this, or I'll suggest she'll address it. The stress and the anxiety causes women to internally examine themselves to make sure the bleeding is stopped, right? They have to do that from the day their period ends, all 7 days before they go to the mikvah. I've heard women who were taught 3 times a day as if it's, instead of, you don't have to daven, right? Women are not, you don't have to pray, but you should, like, shacharit mincha mariv, do your bedikas. I find that astonishing. That's not in any, you know, real halachic literature 3 times a day. Twice a day is mentioned, because in the time of the temple, women who were making challah for the priests would check in the morning and in the afternoon to make sure they hadn't become impure and contaminated the challah. Really once a day is enough, but it's a period of time which causes tremendous amount of anxiety and often impedes women's sexuality, you know, feelings of sexuality, because they feel, again, it's very controlled. They have to ask the rabbi. Sometimes if they get a yoetzet, but even that's not so pleasant. And I had a woman, 40 years old, she just had her 6th child, Israeli woman. She went and actually studied these laws carefully in a place called Machon Pua, so she would be educated, because she felt like, again, it caused her so much stress, she needed to go study more. And she called me crying because she had a question. And she said, you know what they don't teach you? How this is going to make you cry almost every month, like how emotional this is. And there are often times I call, again, when I can't answer the question myself, it's a question that is more complicated and I consult. You know, I'll start off asking the question and the rabbi will say, I consult one particular rabbi I like to talk to, he'll say, no, and I'll say, does it, she's crying. And then he sometimes stops to think. Now, not all women cry, let me say that. There are women who, when they're told, no, you can't go to the mikvah, no, you need to wait a few more days, will take it well. I mean, I don't want to say all women are crying over this. But there's no question this touches on feelings of anxiety, insecurity, the emotional spectrum, the fact that I'm prohibited and all I want to do is get to the mikvah to be permitted because I want to hug and we're not touching and so on. These are serious issues that I think don't get talked about. And I think that what's happened with the challah instruction is a lot of times the challah teacher wants to really not just inspire the woman to understand you are holding the key to, you know, your family's happiness and spirituality, and the men go to learn Torah and daven and look what you get to do, and like this is just as important, and so on and so forth. Yes, so on and so forth. And wow, you know, and I'm not saying looking for spiritual meaning is a good thing, but I don't. Hopefully today it's changed, and the fact that more women are studying has changed it. But I think not enough conversation goes on at how challenging this is going to be as a couple and as a woman who often has to deal with parts of herself that she may be uncomfortable dealing with. Let's put it this way. Women who don't like to insert anything vaginally, who don't want to touch themselves every month, right? And then the fact that they have to, or don't have to, but or don't. They don't, and then they feel guilty that they don't, because is their husband's lot in the Garden of Eden being impeded by this and so on. A lot of it is how they were taught, how threatened they were by how they taught. Again, the big stick of you will burn in hell kind of thing if you don't do this right. Or this is your spiritual salvation, or this is going to feel very spiritual to you, but it's not spiritual to me. And again, Jody can talk about some of those issues. Are things that, you know, as I said, in a respectful, healthy, loving relationship can cause stress. In a bad relationship, this is poison. Men who demand to see their wives' bedikas on a regular level, who insist on taking every cloth, every exam cloth to the rabbi to make sure their wife is doing... I mean, unfortunately, we all know abuse can really manifest itself in that way. And women who misuse the mikvah, who say, look, I'm nida, to tease their husbands, right? Because they don't, I'm not talking about the women who don't want to go to the mikvah because they don't want to resume intimacy. That's a different problem. I'm talking about women who use it, again, misuse their power, if you will. Oh, I'm Nida. Oh, no, I'm not. Oh, yes, I am, right? So again, not only men play games or have control, sometimes women do as well, or sleep with your husband and then say, oh, I was Nida, by the way. Ha ha, you're going, you know, again, in a bad relationship, this kind of thing gives unprecedented power to both sides at times, and so something to be aware of. I'll talk about meaning. I'm not going to leave you with just the bad stories. I'm just bringing up challenges because I think not enough is talked about that. Behavior when the wife is Nida. So I'm not going to have time to go through all these sources now. I'm going to actually do what I often do is reduce it into the to circle, into, you know, the central point and then the circles around it. The challenge really, again, language. These laws are called harchakot. Harchakot means distancings, to be distance, laws that distance. The purpose of these laws is actually not to distance the couple. It's to desexualize a sexual relationship, which is something totally different. And in fact, as we go through the categories of law, what we'll see is that the rabbinic, you know, chazal, the rabbinic establishment, never intended for couples to be distanced. In fact, they keep them in the same bedroom, eating at the same table, sitting next to each other, talking lovingly to each other. However, it's a challenge then, because it's a couple that's permitted sexually, right? It's not a father, daughter, brother, sister, and so on. So we do have to be, I don't like to use the word suspicious, we certainly have to understand the challenge for a couple living together, sleeping next to each other, continuing to have romance and intimacy and affection, and then saying to them, okay, but no sexuality, right? That there's a challenge there, and then the halachic system is going to come in and build the fences that it builds to protect us from the, you know, the central prohibition, which is really the sexual relationship. Okay, and so really, I'm going to get back to the touching towards the end, but really, there are four circles. Sex is in the middle. No one disputes that having sex when you're nida is not a prohibition, right? That's more or less accepted across the board. It's the language of the Torah, punishment, karet. Okay. The first circle, as I said, is touch. The halachic attitude is touch is potentially sexual in a sexually permitted relationship. Again, a father, daughter, brother, sister, hug away. You know, we're not going to be overly concerned. Maybe, again, in an ultra-Orthodox community, I'm putting that on the side. But the halachic literature is not concerned about first-degree incestuous relationships, because that touch is not supposed to be sexual. And as we saw last week, they actually weren't concerned for same-sex relationships either, meaning their feeling was our communities are not, you know, men can sleep under a blanket naked in an inn together because we're not concerned that there's going to be sexual touching, and women as well. We are concerned when we have a husband and a wife who are permitted to each other and cannot have sex, because that's really not natural. I mean, that's an unnatural request. It's challenging because it's unnatural. And I'm going to say something further. It's not bad for them to be sexually attracted, to actually start fooling around, and it's not immoral. The seven mitzvahs of B'nai Noach, what we demand of those who are moral Gentiles, does not include Nida, right? What the seven mitzvot include are, you know, don't commit adultery, don't murder, and so on and so forth. This is not a moral piece. This is a religious piece. And so touch becomes the first kind of fence around sexuality, because touch can become sexual very quickly and should. I mean, I often say to couples that, you know, the hug at the end of the day where someone had a bad day, it doesn't matter who, suddenly dopamine receptors go ding, 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 right? And suddenly what starts as a hug in the middle of the hug becomes sexual. And that's very normal. That's a good thing, right? And then suddenly you don't want to just finish hugging and, you know, you want to start moving on to other things. You know, you end up making out on the sofa, or occasionally you call the Nishmat hotline and say, we had sex and we're really sorry. What should we do? How do we do penitence? And hopefully you get a reasonably, you know, sympathetic answer, you know, woman who answers the phone who says, look, just try to build your month differently next time, meaning try to be a little, you know, figure out, you know, ways of building your fences a little stronger. There's no, you know, bring a korban when the Beit HaMikdash is, you know, save your sacrifices, like you said, three Hail Marys. The next fence is the bedroom. And here too, again, there's no mandate to leave the bedroom, or, you know, the sharing a sexual space is absolutely permitted. The question is, what are you going to do in that space? So then the question is the bed, right? Rav Padat goes up against his colleagues. Rav Padat basically says, well, if they each sleep in their own blankets, Again, remember at that time, largely they were sleeping naked under the blanket. So if everyone's in their own blanket, then that'll be okay. That's already some degree of separation. And his colleagues retort with a rather weak logical retort, but an interesting one. How would you feel, how would a woman feel if she came home and found her husband in bed fully clothed with the neighbor's wife? Would that feel okay? I mean, they're both fully clothed in bed. The answer being that sharing a bed is a sexual space. And so the halakhic response to that is two beds. Okay, that's where we get the, you know, many religious couples have two beds. Again, not all. There's a spectrum. Some couples go with Rav Padat. They may not know they're going with Rav Padat, but they do. They have the one big bed. And then when they're prohibited, they each have their own blankets and pillows and so on. So, you know, each roll to their side of the mattress. But largely the halakha mandates two beds. And again, that's where you get the frame you buy in this country, which is one frame with mattresses that move apart. They don't have to be like this. Some couples want them to be like this because some couples want the reminder, right? They want to make the non-sexual space really non-sexual. And some couples don't want to lose the intimacy and the romance. And so they have it like this, right? And the idea is if you roll, you hit the crack, right? As opposed to keep rolling. So that's really the purpose of having two beds. So you don't roll into each other's beds and forget that this is non-sexual time. The next space that gets looked at is the eating space. And as we know, you know, eating can be a very intimate experience. I often say to couples, the first sign that someone's going out is when they start eating and drinking from each other's food and drink, right? You take your boyfriend's Coke or he takes a lick from your ice cream and you say, oh, I guess they're going out. I've been wondering, but now I know, right? Eating together as a family, friends, and then as couples creates a bond of intimacy. It's an intimate experience. And as we know from movies and from literature, it can be a very erotic experience. Meaning even Disney didn't go with erotic, but they did the Lady and the Tramp where they eat spaghetti and then they come to kiss, right? How cute. And we all say, oh, that's so cute. They're playing with this idea that when we get close to one another, eating spaghetti can sometimes lead to kissing. And that's not, and, you know, then they get married in, you know, their doggy way, right. But the point is that food can be, and yet the halakhic literature does not require that couples sit at different tables. They eat at the same table. They can stare soulfully into each other's eyes. But what? They have their own utensils, plate, and cup. They don't serve one another, and they don't eat from each other's plates. So again, mindfulness, recognition, a change in space, creating a different space at a time where you're prohibited, to remember, oh, this is it's not harchaka time, meaning in terms of being distant. We're going to be close, but we're going to figure out a way to be close. Be like, I always say, be like this and not like this, right? That's really what you want to be. Near each other, but not fully integrated into one another. And there also, the halakhic literature talks about putting something on the table, like when someone eats meat and someone eats milk, right? Really, when people eat different things, so you don't reach over and eat cheese fries while you're eating a hamburger or vice versa, or someone doesn't take your schnitzelonim when they're eating pizza. The idea is when people eat together in a group, it's a bonding experience. People often eat off of each other's plates, especially if they're roommates or friends. The idea is if one is eating meat and one is eating milk, they should have a reminder on the table. Similar idea. Okay, and so that's the eating space. The last space, and the one that often couples say, really, the passing. That's the last piece that I have there. The passing. The passing started with Rashi. Now remember, Rashi's 1100, so everything else is Talmud. Rashi's 1100. Rashi did not pass keys to his wife. When his students saw that, they loved the idea. Oh, yet another fence to put up, right? So we won't pass things either, lest we come to touch one another. I will say that the passing, I often say again to couples in the beginning, but once you have kids, a lot of this, you know, the passing, some people remain stringent and good for them. But many people will say, once we have a baby and we're passing diapers and babies and wipes and God knows what, all to each other, the passing thing kind of settles down a little bit. But I often say, again, mindfulness. I like the word mindfulness in this place. You're changing your space from permitted to prohibited. It's not an easy space to navigate. Sometimes having little reminders that this is a different desexualized space is helpful in maintaining whatever it is you're striving to maintain. And so passing doesn't have to seem misogynistic or unfriendly. It can, again, be looked at as a reminder. And when we're in the house, we're going to be particularly stringent because here we are alone and the bed is waiting for us in the bedroom and that's all we can kind of think about. So we're going to be a little more stringent. But when we're out, okay, we'll be a little more relaxed. We're out with people, we're at a restaurant, we're at my parents' house and so on and so forth. Not everyone needs to know your nita, right? There is an element of privacy. The couple can maintain privacy. What's interesting, and then in the Middle Ages, we begin to see that couples themselves from tshuvas and so on, began to distinguish between the days in which a woman had her period and when the days she counted. Now that's interesting because it's one unified spectrum of prohibition, right? It's just one continuum. From the day I get my period till I go to the mikvah, I'm prohibited. But people are people. And that goes back to what you're saying, how educated or how much do they choose not to understand. What the women did, the students of Rashi write this, they had a custom to distinguish between days of bleeding and the clean days. During their periods, they wouldn't bathe. They would wear the same clothes. They would feel, again, one imagines, hormonally, you're kind of down in the dumps. You don't feel good. And then as soon as their periods ended, they began to freshen up. Right? They changed into new clothes. They bathed. They began serving their husbands. They sometimes began to touch their husbands casually and so on. And they began to accustom themselves to sinful behavior. I think that's so wonderful because it shows that, first of all, this has been a challenge for a long time. Like, it's not 2015. Oh, only now, because we're such a promiscuous society, we can't make it to the end of 12 days. It seems like even in Rashi's time, couples struggled with maintaining a continuum of prohibition for 12 days. Okay? The other thing is there's a famous story, which also I believe is here, where it appears, it has Eliyahu Anavi, which already tells you it's not meant to be a historical story. It's on page 7. That a man who was very learned died when he was young. And his wife was really upset, and she went with his tefillin from study hall to study hall. And she said, well, why did he die? He was a very good man. He was a righteous man. And Eliyahu shows up, which is always not going to be, I mean, when Eliyahu shows up, the story's not going to end well. Okay, Eliyahu is a bit harsh in his educational methods. Although there are some stories where he's a little more gentle. But here he's particularly harsh. And he says to her, what's the first thing he asks her? As if he knows what to ask. He's Elijah, after all. During the days of your nidut, what did he do with you? God forbid, he did not touch me even on my little finger. I'm at the bottom of page 7. On your wife days, what did he do with you? She said, well, he ate with me, drank with me, slept with me without clothing, but he didn't even think about anything else. So Elijah then says, well, blessed is God who killed him because he did not show respect for the Torah. Okay, again, a very harsh verdict being passed down. But this story ends up emerging and reemerging in the Middle Ages, and I would suggest a story like this is clearly a response to behavior, meaning that people themselves are saying, look, when a woman gets her period, we don't really know what that's about, and it seems a little contaminating and like, ew, and the women themselves feel kind of grungy and so on and so forth. But once the period's over, everyone starts feeling better, the hormones start flowing, and the men and women start behaving a little more frivolously, if you will. And so a story like this suddenly begins to circulate quite a bit in the Middle Ages to give a warning of what will happen if you do not respect the system as it stands. So really, again, very quickly, I just really threw out a lot of these ideas at you. But what we're going to see, and you know, maybe Jody will touch on as well, is the challenges this poses. I mean, again, whether it's couples who say, look, we are committed to this from beginning to end, and then find out they don't stay committed to it. So again, the price they pay for that, you know, kind of the guilt or the stress, or one it remains committed, another one's like, yeah, this really isn't doing it for me. Again, I'm not talking about people who actually have sex when they're nida. Nomi Marmon Grummet did her doctorate studying 50 couples and their behavior during the nida period. She found quite a spectrum, but she did not include couples who don't keep nida at all, even though they define themselves as Orthodox. Again, that's interesting because you always thought, well, Shabbat, Kashrut, and Nida, that's what you do to be Orthodox. Now, it turns out that nothing is ever as simple as it seems. So she didn't include those, but she found, and this is what I'm finding also, is that there's really a spectrum from people who keep everything and embrace it, people who keep everything and hate it, right, really resent it, people who start making allowances, they pass. I had a friend, she's very, very frum, and when I asked her, I was asking her what she did. You know, because I go around collecting information. She's like, oh, well, we pass. That's really bad, isn't it? I'm like, okay, no, you're really okay. You pass? Okay. They have 6 kids. I'm like, okay, you know, you pass because you have... She goes, sometimes we pass. I'm like, okay. So you have those who, again, will feel a little bit like sheepish that I'm not complying with everything, but what can I do? Life kind of gets in the way. And then you have others who eat off each other's plates, or, you know, Shabbos with the Kiddush cup, they drink from the Kiddush cup together, which they're not supposed to do. You have those who have one bed, but decide they're not going to touch. And then you have those who say, look, we're going to touch, we're going to try not to sexually touch, right? And so you really get a spectrum of how people make this their kadoshim, what I call their kadoshim to you. And I think that, you know, again, without explaining, apologizing, defending, or anything, I think human behavior is often what creates The human interaction with the system is what makes the system either meaningful or unsustainable. And in the two or three minutes I have left, I'll talk a little bit. I've talked a lot about the challenges. I'll talk about meaning, because I think let's end on a positive note, right? Where does meaning come from in this system? So first of all, obviously there are those who are very good halachic Jews or are very spiritual Jews or whatever it is they are, and this system works for them. They find a teacher, or they find a rabbi that explains this in such a way that it resonates, and they go in, and again, hopefully the woman's cycle is exactly the way it should be, and there are no curveballs, and everything works, and they find it fits well with their sexual flow, ebb and flow, and so on and so forth. So there are those who really, you know, who don't have issues. For those who have, who struggle, I often say, look, it's a process. I mean, don't expect it to automatically bring you Gan Eden in the bedroom just because, you know, some of the books talk about perpetual honeymoons. Not everyone wants to go back to their honeymoon, and they don't want it to be perpetual. And not everyone, for not everyone, it's a honeymoon. Not everyone, it's a wonderful experience. And so I often say there are really two places where I think couples can try to think a little bit outside the box. One is that it can, you know, again, if you desexualize a relationship, it forces communication. Again, instead of makeup sex, you have to work through a fight if you're prohibited. That's not a bad thing to learn how to do through language, through using, you know, whether it's writing, emailing today, SMSing today, hopefully face-to-face conversation. Sometimes touch does distract us, meaning it's much easier to say I love you by giving a hug than actually find the words of saying I love you. And so for some couples, I have a very good friend, really, she and her husband are halachic men and women, halachic man and halachic woman, and she said, look, it never occurred to them, you know, we grew up, we were roommates actually, we were very good friends. She said, of course there were times it was hard, but they were committed from the beginning on the same exact page, and really they learned, she felt their relationship was deepened by being sexually prohibited through, again, language, talking, learning to talk through fights or difficult periods and so on and so forth. Okay. That's the ideal, by the way. That, I mean, halavai, everyone should experience it that way. There are others who will say, look, you know, we have to find our rhythm, we have to find our flow, we have to find some month. I often say, you can look at it month by month, a little like balei tshuva, right? When people become religious, we often say to them, one Shabbos, right? We say, one Shabbos, or just stop eating milk and meat together. You don't have to go out and kosher your all. Just take it slow. Couples who get married are often, well, this is it. You know, here's the whole system. Wham, bam. You know, yeah, I didn't want to go with that. That's not the right ending. But here it is, lock, stock, and barrel. And now, you know, figure it out. I would say be kind. No, I often say be kind. Take it on a monthly basis, meaning try to find ways of being mindful of how the month is going to look and where the struggle is. I had one couple who came to talk to me where for her, she needs a hug at the end of every day. So she's willing to bend the rules a little because she emotionally needs a hug. But for her husband, it becomes sexual immediately. And he's like, look, I'm going to give you a hug, but let me just tell you, it's going to go to making out very quickly. Why? Because for me, the touch is sexual. So if you're asking me to give you a touch. So again, that's a couple that's going to have to spend some time trying to figure out a balance, right? But at the end of the day, you know, trying to figure out ways in which the system can bring you closer. And the last piece is really the prohibited permitted spectrum, which in long term, 20, 30 years, can certainly foster desire. Meaning again, if you work at it, if you are mindful of it, it reminds you to have sex. Meaning people get to a stage where they have three or four or five kids, both have jobs, old ailing parents, meaning there's no question that there's a stage where desire wanes a little bit, or for one or for the other, and then who has time? And everyone wants to go to sleep at night. Meaning, and so at least the mikvah builds in mindfulness of, oh, yeah, I was just prohibited for 12 days. We were just prohibited. Now it's time for us to reconnect sexually. So we're not going to go months and months and months without having sex. We're going to, you know, in fact, women sometimes approaching menopause will express a certain fear. There are those who say, woo, this is great. No more nida. Usually the years before you finally lose your period are so horrible because you're spotting all the time. I mean, it's just such a halachic minefield that they're grateful when it's finally over. But some of them will express concern. What are we going to do? Meaning like we had this great ebb and flow where we, you know, where, you know, the sexuality becomes not just about objectification or self-pleasure. It really becomes part of the ebb and flow of our marriage. And it creates tremendous, you know, reunification and vigor and so on. And as much as it was challenging, it really added to our marital relationship. And so that's where I'll close. I think, again, every couple obviously has to find their stride, their kedoshim tiyu, their way of creating sanctity within their relationship. Ultimately, I think these laws can contribute, but it has to be an ongoing dialogue. And I think, obviously, people, like in any other part of their relationships, have to listen to each other and respect each other. Jody, do you want to pick up for a few minutes?
We'll just talk for a few minutes about a few things that Nahama brought up. First of all, when she, I have to say this, when you spoke about comparing the kitchen,
yeah,
and that it's very hard to trafe up a kitchen, we managed.
Oh, good.
Yes, no, we managed.
Oh, you're
yes, we used to trafe up her mother's kitchen all the time. It was a talent. So I'm going to put in a little plug for the Eden Center, which is, Nahama mentioned, Naomi Mormon Grummet and her doctorate. We're going to be doing a series in Beit Shemesh on sexuality and sanctity, more of a workshop for women. And I was trying to come up with a name for it, because the name that we used for it in Modi'in, we decided we need to modify for Beit Shemesh. In Modi'in, we called it Let's Talk About It. In Beit Shemesh, we realized we need to have something a little bit more delicate. So I was looking through Bereishit, Perek Aleph, because that's where I get pretty much all of my, if I can spend my entire life only on that perek, I won't be bored. And I realized that when you also brought up the idea of perpetual honeymoon and it's not Gan Eden, and you know, the concept of Lo'ovdau L'Shamra, that we have to work for it and we have to be able to take care of it. Or as my kids say in Israel, keep on it, because they think that's what it means. We have, and I think that a marriage or a long-term relationship really is something that we have to keep in mind, those two words, lo'ovdau l'shamra. It's not something that comes easily. It's something that we have to work for. It's something that we have to guard and we have to protect and we have to really nourish. So when we talk about the laws of Tarat HaMishpacha and Hilchot Nida, it's not easy. It's not an easy process, and it's a process that everybody, every couple, as Nahama said, has to approach it in their own way and be able to experience it. I like the idea of, I like to use the term semi-permeable membrane for anyone who's studied biology. Anyone studied biology, right? It's a boundary, but it's a boundary with some sort of flexibility. And when we have these boundaries that we learn from the halachic boundaries in our mind, we have to remember that we're human beings and that we have to learn to incorporate these halachot into our own lifestyles. So when you think about, I was just working on this with actually a client today, about the fact that the boundaries that were given by halacha really protect us. And they're shomrim otanu. They keep us within they give us a range, a permissible range, and then we have to work within it. Sometimes this can be a little bit anxiety provoking. And when we talk about the bidikot and, the women checking themselves during their seven clean days, that's something that I deal with very often with my clients. It's not an easy process. There are women, like Nahama mentioned, that have trouble inserting the bidika clause, inserting anything. They have issues, they say so often, they'll say, but we don't have to keep the time, mitzvot aseh shehazman grama, the time-bound mitzvot.
This is so time-bound.
And this is the most time-bound. So some people will say, well, that's why you don't have to keep the time-bound mitzvot, because you have to be in tune with your body on a regular basis. So, but it's very difficult, especially, as we'll talk about next week, when we talk about sexuality through the life cycle. There are times in our life that it's just very hard to be able to do these checks. Whether you're in college and university, we're in Israel, and you're in the middle of a class, and all of a sudden you're like, oh! Right? And your teacher is there, and you're in
do the checks before sundown.
Yes, sorry. You have to do the checks
before. You don't have an unlimited amount of time. You can't sit, right? You have from morning till sundown, which can be in the winter, a very short window.
Yeah, right, especially when the clocks change. And as we have children and as we get older, we have all different responsibilities. There are a lot of anxieties that can come. And there are different women and couples. I don't want to just say women, because the husbands are involved in this also. The spouses are involved in this also, and have a reaction to different reactions to how to deal with this. Is it something that's going to make you very anxious? Is it something that's going to make you feel like all I can think about is doing these checks? All I can think about is what if. I have a client now that says, all I can think about is what if it comes out questionable? What if there's a stain? What if I have to ask someone? And the what ifs become a sort of a vicious cycle. And then there's an anxiety. And that's something that we work on, that I work on very often with clients. The question the woman's responsibility. All of this is on my shoulders, which Nechama alluded to before also. All of this is on my shoulders. What if I make a mistake? You know, this is the one place that there's ne'emanut ha'isha, that the woman is recognized as say, how do you say it in English?
She's believed.
Her word is absolute, exactly. You know, what if I mess this one up? This is a really, really big one. So there's a lot of anxiety that comes with that. Questions of including our spouse. You know, does our spouse know that we are up to day two or up to day three? What is their part in this process? What about I'm just trying to think of the things. This is a really big one. With the laws of Nida, we are reminded of the prohibitions that we felt before we got married. For people that kept the laws of Nigia, which we talked about 2 times ago, I think, all of a sudden you feel like you're married and everything is permitted and you get used to that, and then all of a sudden, wait a second, how do we do this? When we weren't married, it wasn't permitted, but we weren't necessarily living together. We didn't have the permission of the fact that we were married. We weren't in this state that we're permitted upon each other. And all of a sudden it throws us back to the isurim, to the prohibitions, and that can cause a tremendous amount of cognitive dissonance and emotional dissonance. Like, how do I handle this? And it's something that comes up on a regular basis. This is not something that we necessarily get used to, as, again, we'll talk about it more next week, as our life changes, our relationship changes. I don't want to talk too much because I want to leave the time for questions. But I do want to bring up a book by Gary Chapman called The Five Love Languages. Anyone familiar with that book? Yeah? Great book, right? He talks about 5 different ways that couples communicate with one another. I'm going to try to get it. Whoever read the book is going to have to help me because I always leave one out. 5 different languages that people feel that they are loved, or feel that that's their way of expressing their love. One is physical touch, right? If you love someone, you hug them, you stroke them, you kiss them, all the way from casual touch to sexual touch. Another is words, right? Communicating through words of affirmation, bless you, saying God bless you, saying I care about you, saying let's talk, let's sit and talk, let me tell you about my day, let me hear how your day was, saying, wow, you look beautiful tonight, right? How frustrating is it when you get dressed and you come downstairs and no one, and everyone, oh, okay, are you ready? Wow, you look beautiful. Wow, you really, you know, you want, some people really need to hear those things. So we said touch, words of affirmation, time. Some people really just want to spend time together. I don't care if you could tell me you love me every day when you're walking out to work and come back, but I just want to sit and be with you. I just want to spend the time together. I want to know that I'm a priority, and that's how I know I'm a priority, because of you're giving me your time. Another one is gift giving. And that can be, gift giving can be anything from, and here I'm now thinking about the last one that I always forget. Gift giving can be anything from, you know, walking down the street and seeing a little tchotchke, a cup of coffee, and knowing that, you know, that that will be such a nice thing to give because it shows I'm thinking about you, up until a diamond whatever or a beautiful watch, or it can be anything, but actually giving something tangible. So we said, who's keeping track? Time?
Service.
Yeah, we need acts of service. Acts of service, thank you, because that's the one I usually forget. Acts of service means doing something for someone else. Taking out the garbage is always a big one. It comes up all the time. Doing the dishes, picking up, you know, whatever it is at the post office, bringing the kids to school or to gun. So some people think, well, I need you to do things for me to know that you're sharing with me. To know, now, here's the catch: The catch is what I may think is, what may be my love language, knowing that I like to talk, right? Very often it's the women that like to talk, but it's not exclusively. I like to talk, and I really, my husband's may not be talk. It may be acts of service, acts of kindness, I think it's actually, acts of kindness. So he may be doing all these things, like making the kids Aruch HaDeser, and, you know, all of these things. And I'm and to me, that's not really showing me that he loves me. That's showing me that he's their father, and he has to make them Aruch HaDeser. So the question is, the idea is to understand your own love language, to understand your partner's love language, and to be able to communicate those to one another, and to again, work, you know, within that flexibility. So I recommend that book to everyone, and now we'll open up for questions.
I just want to say one thing. Number one, I know the first thing after I got married, just a funny story, is after we came out of the yichud room, I went over to a friend, and I'm like, no guilt. Like, it was this feeling of relief that, like, now we can touch and there'd be no guilt attached. Of course, that lasted for as long as we got to the next, you know, month, and we couldn't make it through the month without touching. So, you know, then the guilt came back.
But talking about acts of service, very important point, mikveh night. Because, again, there's this myth that mikveh night is everyone's having great sex. And the transition from permitted to prohibited is a tough one. I talked about that. No one likes to be prohibited, regardless of where they are on the spectrum of keeping these halachot. But it turns out the other direction, once you desexualize to resexualize, again, for some, you know, they go at it, they come home and everyone's on the same page and it's all good. But for many, it's a transition also. And I think that's a transition that doesn't get talked about enough. If the bedikas were stressful, if doing the exams, if going to the mikvah, if having to have a mikvah attendant when you don't really want one, if, you know, there are all sorts of things that can touch a woman. So the man opens the door with a big smile. Hi, honey, you're home. And she's like, don't talk to me. Don't touch me. I don't want to think. I'm going into my room and shutting the door. Leave me alone. Right. That's not an unusual occurrence, or the anxiety of, oh, you know, it's been so long. I'm a little nervous, you know, about reconnecting sexually. And that's where I often say men, or the one staying home, can certainly do something significant, whether it's something as simple as cleaning up the house, right? Or putting the kids to bed if there are kids, or making dinner, or buying flowers. There's always something to transition. It's a transition. Now, again, if both couples are very much like, we're going to a wedding tonight, or you know what, we're both on the same page, and we've been waiting for 7 days, and we've been sitting on our hands, and we just need that release, that's also great. But I think it's important to say that for many couples, it's not as obvious or as easy as transition as the literature seems to make it sound. And sometimes talking about it, I really need you too. I had a Pardes student who said to me that, you know, she wasn't religious, and he was, and so she was going to the mikvah for him, and she said, she found it very sweet that she would come home and there would be like, he would cook a different dinner every month and he'd set the table. And it sounds like, oh, isn't that obvious? No, it's not obvious. I think it's not obvious. And I think men often disassociate. Well, this is your thing. I can't do the bedikas. I wish I could. I wish I could go to the mikvah for you. No, you don't. But I wish I could do more. I had actually a husband say that to me. I wish I could do it for her. It was so stressful for his wife that it was very sweet. He said, I wish I could do these for her. He can't. But I think that then requires men or partners to think more carefully about how they're going to validate, acknowledge, and transition from the prohibited to permitted. Okay, questions?
Okay, I want to rebut.
Yeah.
I want to respond to what you said also. That's something that